Welcome to the Diversity Remix, only provocative conversations at the intersection of business, politics, and culture. I'm Charlie Echeverry.
And I'm Jesus Chavez.
Today's episode, Divided We Stand. In our deep dive today, how can it be that fundamentally different conceptions of reality seem to exist among Americans with respect to the election, the media, and the fairness of their platforms? And in our Courage or Cringe segment, Governor Northam of Virginia, Goya's Employee of the Month, and the Cleveland Indians. Are elected officials entitled to add religious opinions to their executive actions, or do those automatically encroach on our First Amendment? Should CEO opinions be visible in the social realm, or should those CEOs focus on running their business in a nonpartisan way? And finally, do sports teams have a responsibility to ensure their team names and mascots are unoffensive, or should fans be a bit more flexible? These items, and I'm sure some more, on this episode of TDR. All right, Jesus, welcome back. Welcome back. Got our new setup in the old studio.
I know.
Trying to get the audio
I'm
to
be. I'm curious to see how people will be able to tell the difference.
Nobody will notice.
No one notices.
Actually, not even I will really notice, but I'll convince myself that I actually do hear things.
Right.
There's a podcast that I listen to called Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which I recommend to anybody who is interested in kind of like mysteries and kind of detective-like stuff. And he was talking, one of the shows was, I don't think he's actually done it, but one of the shows that he's going to be doing is about this apparent sound that many people in Taos, New Mexico, seem to hear, like just random humming that people seem to hear. And one of the theories that he has is, like, you know, you can suggest to yourself a lot of things. Like if you sit there and just listen to static long enough, you may actually begin, because the brain does patterns. Mm-hmm. So maybe be able to find kind of patterns. Anyway, that's me with audio. Like I will sit there and obsess over every word. And, you know, as I told our producer, I think I mentioned to you that I'm not, I'd love for people to love all the content here, but this will be the best sounding podcast on the planet. That's my goal.
I'm so, just glad you care that much, because if you didn't, man, we'll be in trouble, because I can't tell half the time. Well, I mean, I could tell the extremes, I guess.
Yeah.
And yeah. I've even realized that now. I even cringe when I hear some of those that are super echoey, et cetera.
Oh my gosh.
So I've gotten better.
There's so many of them.
My ear has gotten better.
There you go.
I've been able to pick up the differences, well, I guess.
That is my quest. Okay. So we've got an exciting show. Very interesting deep dive topic, which probably could go the distance of the whole show time, but we're going to have to probably parse things out, because it's a pretty deep topic. So we've got a lot to get into. But before we do, I did want to talk about our sponsor for this episode of the Diversity Remix, and our sponsor is Sofisa.org, Sofesa.org. Sofisa is a labor of love. It's actually of my and my wife's, how would you say that grammatically? My wife and mine?
Yeah, you're asking the wrong person.
Yeah. So anyway, my wife and I have a nonprofit. We've had it for about 20 years. It's called Sofisa, and it's a 501c3 nonprofit. It serves homeless and low-income kids and their families here in Southern California. And the whole laser focus of this nonprofit is to help kids suspend survival mode. You know, Jesus, when you're, you know, in situations where either you don't have a home or you're in kind of transient living situations, you're kind of trying to survive. And so you're not really thinking creatively. You're just thinking about what happens next at that moment. You're not able to kind of let your brain unspool and enjoy those kind of moments of creativity and community and things like that, and ultimately grow in who you are. So our nonprofit, of which you've also been a benefactor and been involved with yourself, is really all about kind of helping kids escape survival mode. We've been doing this for 20 years, and we do it principally by creating events throughout the year for these kids. And we've done everything over the years, from trips to the theater, to cooking classes, to barbecues, to music concerts, to our largest event. And the reason why this message is coming out to you today, of our Christmas of Hope celebration. Now, our Christmas of Hope celebration is usually an event that's physical, obviously. We bring together, I mean, you were involved last year, Jesus. We brought, I think, 117 kids together for a really great night. This year, very different, because obviously there's COVID, so that tends to put a damper on things. It is our 14th year doing this Christmas of Hope party, and even though we're not able to physically bring kids and their families together for this celebration, we're not going to let coronavirus stop us from experiencing the joy of Christmas. So over the next couple of weeks, As you listen to this podcast, if you're listening to this podcast, we will be safely and individually delivering to nearly 100 kids. Actually, it's actually now over 100 kids. 100 kids, a holiday package of gifts and resources that'll make their Christmas feel brighter. And so Sofisa humbly asks for your help in actually doing this. You can sponsor a child. There is a $99 tax-deductible gift that sponsors one child so that they can receive a variety of items, stuffed stocking with gifts for each child. They get a gingerbread house. They get gift cards. They get grocery cards, personal PPE, personal protection equipment, right? So face shields and hand sanitizers, masks, all that stuff. And, of course, what every kid wants, which are toys, assorted, a variety of assorted toys. So every kid gets a package of these things, and you can sponsor one of these kids for $99, a tax-deductible gift. To find out more, please go to sofisa.org, that is S-O-F-E-S-A.org, and sponsor at least one kid, but certainly sponsor as many kids as you like, and help them have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. So thank you to our friends at sofisa.org. All right, Jesus, big topic. I'll let you tee us off as you normally do. Where do we begin? How do we begin?
You know, I think we've been purposely staying out of not trying to talk too much about politics, and specifically not about the election over the last few episodes. And mostly because it's been so, you know, in all of our minds, I think collectively, it's been such an issue that it's been hard to sort of take a break from it. So we have purposely given a pause. But this data came out just this past week that we thought would be really interesting to actually talk about. So there was a poll that was conducted by Gallup in partnership with the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. And, you know, this, it was basically a survey that was done both pre-election, about a month before election, from September 24th through October 5th, that had about 1,500 respondents. And then a post-election survey that was completed between November 9th and the 15th, through the 15th, with another 2,700 respondents, right? And a bunch of data came out of that as it relates to how people viewed the election process, how much they believed the results that were being, communicated through media, their thought about sort of the view that the media played and how well informed people felt, or disinformed for that matter. So great little nuggets all over the place. So this is what we want to probably need to parse out quite a bit. But let's start with the biggest one, which is frankly what, when I saw this headline, and once again, we look at headlines, we got to double click into them to make sure that it's not just a headline and it's what the data is actually saying. But when I read this, it really shocked me. And the headline was as follows, that 83% of Republicans that were polled by this Gallup study after the 2020 election said they didn't believe Joe Biden won. Right. And that by itself, to me, kind of like, it's like a pause, you know, stop the presses kind of announcement. When you see that, when you see such a large percentage of, if you think about the number of people that consider this a Republican, of course, this is a sample size of that. But if that holds true to the broader group, that is a very large share of Republicans that just don't believe the election process. Now, one thing to immediately start to sort of caveat here is this is relative to the time where this study was done, November 9th through the 12th. So the first thing that I did is immediately was like, what was happening around November 9th, right? And at that point, the election had already been called for Joe Biden, as Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin had already been called. Which at that point eclipsed the 270 electoral votes that are required for a new president, or for any president. One of the exceptions in terms of states that hadn't been called yet was Arizona. It hadn't been called by the broader media, but it had been called literally the night of election by Fox News, and then also followed by AP. In this case, Fox News being the very first one to call Arizona. But it wasn't until November 12th, which is basically after this time period, of which the rest of the media, well, actually, I guess during this time period, or which the rest of the media outlets called Arizona as well. But this notion that, and we looked at the numbers, 63% of Americans said they believed the news media projections of Joe Biden as the winner of the election were accurate. Now, if you break it down between party, it was 99% of Democrats, which, you know, not makes sense.
Only one person.
Only 1%.
Only one person didn't think so.
99% of Democrats, 64% of independents.
Which to me is like a really low number.
Yeah, I guess it is. It actually is, right? If you think about it, right?
And then 17% of Republicans.
That's what gets you to the 83% of Republicans, you know, polled that they didn't believe that Joe Biden had won, or at least the way that the media was calling it at the time, right? So once again, it's all relative to November 9th through that period, 9th through the 14th. Obviously, a lot has changed since then. this, and a lot has been the same, by the way, a lot of these questions around the political process. But sure, before I get into anything else, I frankly struggle to understand how there could be such a large percentage of people that just didn't believe the process, that it was inaccurate at that point. And you know, I've been actually looking forward to talking to you about this, because, you know, one of the things that I think that I personally have been trying to be much better at is not having a overly simplistic point of view of Trump supporters or the Republican Party, or basically people that have a different point of view than myself. But I got to be honest, if there's been a moment where it really questioned that ability to sort of see things as nuanced, and seeing a number like this as such a large number of a large group that just doesn't believe, or at least at that point didn't believe the process.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this study, I mean, brings to light a lot of the, well, we've already known and talked about, and certainly the whole country's kind of caught up in it, this idea of this sort of deep divide and very polarized moment that we're living in, because the data is all over the place. I mean, on all sides of the spectrum, and we'll get to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. I think the one of the things that I thought about right away was the fact that across the board, the number was pretty low. Now, I know this is made up of average. This is like an average. So right, in a certain way, it's not very helpful, right? But the fact that only 63% of Americans that were polled, and this sample was like 2,000 people, something like that. So it's statistically very significant, right?
Sure.
63% of Americans believed the results of the election. Like, yes, I understand that there was a huge swath of Democrats who
did. Being dragged down by the Republican side.
Well, not really, though. Look at the independents. The independents were 60-something percent.
And it is. I agree with you. That is surprising, right? That 64%, basically two-thirds, right,
of independents
right, you know, believe that the results are right. But right, when you have not even a third, I mean, not even 20%, yeah, even a fifth of Republicans, sure, saying that they believe the process was correct.
Well, and I think some of this,
yeah,
you know,
like, I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, I can tell you that, and well, I'll tell you my thoughts on it.
Am I being dramatic, Charlie?
No. I don't think you're being dramatic. I just think that, you know, look, my thinking is none of this stuff has happened in a vacuum, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
If we kind of woke up here, you know, let's say we were, I don't know, whatever, just pick a year, and over the last 20 or 40 year, 30 years, and we just kind of woke up and suddenly this data happened this way, I'd be like, UFOs are landing. Something's happening.
Yeah.
But nothing happens in a vacuum. And there's at least a few things that I think are part of this, or something to at least allow us to consider. Number one is all of this is happening in the context of a pandemic and the reality of the things that we've been living with in 2020 and all of the, you know, again, we know some of the stats that are up economically, or sorry, down economically. We all know that. We all read all this stuff. But there's also been a pretty significant psychological and emotional toll over the course of this pandemic on all people. So anyway, we're in the context of a pandemic. The second thing is we've never before done mail-in voting ballots at this scale, right? So that's also something new. It's the first time in history we've ever done it at this scale. Number three, we've got social media platforms that, by the way, the interesting thing about this study is, again, it's like literally almost identical. 75% of Republicans, 75% of Democrats agree that the biggest problem in all of this is the social platform. So that we have total alignment on. But we're living in a world where there is deep, deep, deep agreement on the fact that social media platforms have created echo chambers and are moderating conversations in a way that's not ideal. So that's also part of this equation. And lastly, for a lot of reasons that people can justify and that many which I agree with, nevertheless, we have a press that has been extraordinarily antagonistic to this administration. So I think when I look at like how can something like this get to this point among independents and among Republicans, because I'm sure you're not, the 99% of Democrats is like, great, they all agree. But I think we have to consider those four things in our thinking. It's not just like, are these people crazy?
Yeah, it's not that, are these people crazy? What is to me really interesting though about this point here is that 70% of Republicans who, or let me better said, the 83% of Republicans who believe that the basically it was incorrect the way it was being called, that they didn't believe that Joe Biden had won by the 9th of November. It also means the same percentage not believing what Fox News was calling the entire time, because that to me was actually really interesting, right? When you think about the role that most of us that are not, or for those of us that are not on the sort of the right side of the conversation, or the right, or on the left, we tend to think of Fox News as sort of the other extreme, right? If you have MSNBC on one side, you have Fox News on the other, which everything they say, do, et cetera, is always going to be for the benefit of President Trump, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But in this case of the election, they were the first one to call Arizona. Like, weird. As a matter of fact, a lot of issues came out. There were reports that even President Trump was really upset about this, that they ended up calling, you know, Rupert Murdoch to try to get him to change it. But Fox News has been very consistent in terms of calling the election for Joe Biden really early on, right? And this distrust that you see here, it's like, it feels like it happened overnight, that all of a sudden Fox News was no longer the press of choice, that all of a sudden was not part of the mainstream, because Fox News position, at least if you hear, and it's obviously a big distinction between those that are in straight news versus those that are the pundits.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Right, but the pundits always talk about mainstream media as everyone else other than Fox News. But overnight, Fox News became the mainstream media as it relates to a lot of Republicans. When you have this higher percentage of Republicans who don't believe what Fox News is actually saying, forget everybody else. Look, I can understand how hardcore conservatives are never going to believe what MSNBC says. I get that. Just in the same way that you have hardcore liberals who may never believe what Fox News says. Okay, fine.
Right.
But when you have such a large percentage of Republicans that don't believe anymore what Fox News is saying because the outcome is not what they wanted it to be, like, that's the part where I don't understand how overnight that happened.
Well, okay, so a couple things. Number one is, it's pretty clear over the course of the last several months that there's been a falling out of love of the Trump administration and Fox News as their kind of channel to, you know, achieve their kind of PR aims or whatever, because Fox News would historically, if anybody had the president's back, it would be them in terms of either.
They were critical to his first presidency.
Well, they were critical to
him getting elected, for that matter.
They were critical to a lot of things. I mean, so I hope that so first of all, nevertheless, even though they were critical, whatever, Trump definitely started hinting at the fact that Fox's ratings were dropping and all this other stuff, right, as he saw that they were beginning to kind of maybe shift a little bit away from him. I don't know all the intricacies. I didn't do the research, but I could just as a kind of consumer and watcher and person who's knowledgeable on what's going on in the media space, I noticed that. I do hope that this, though, because you just made a statement really fast that I hope people are listened to, which is, I do hope that this lets people take another look at Fox News and maybe other networks,
sure,
and to distinguish between who are pundits and who are news people. Mm-hmm. The people who are calling the election, or like who are there with the, you know, with the things behind them in the map, those people, for the most part, I really do believe, and they're, you know, they have new daily newscasts, they call things pretty straight. Of course, they're going to have a lean. They're people. They have a lean. But they're pundits that, you know, Sean Hannity, right? Tucker Carlson. What's her name? The woman we talked about on a show previously. Blonde woman. I'm forgetting her name. Anyway, Laura Ingraham. Laura Ingraham. Those are people who are opinion journalists, right? And so we need to be able to distinguish between that. And I think in the same way, we should do our best to distinguish somebody like, you know, Anderson Cooper, perhaps, or Jake Tapper from a Rachel Maddow, right? So we have to be able to distinguish. Now, let's also agree, because we're not all naive, that the distinction between straight news and pundit has blurred over the last 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And that's a problem. Yeah. I think that's a big problem. Okay. So I do recognize that. But just going back to your point, though, about this like number that you can't wrap your head around, let's also bear in mind that this same study says that voters were worried about misinformation during this election.
Yeah.
More than 4 in 5 believe that they were exposed to misinformation, and 6 out of 10, including a majority of Republicans, but 6 out of 10 all told, mm-hmm, thought that misinformation swayed the outcome of the election somehow.
Yeah, that's right. Which is really interesting, right? It was 62% of Americans polled, right, that they thought that the outcome of the election was swayed by misinformation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the way that broke out between Democrats and Republicans, 82% of Republicans and 46% of Democrats. What's most interesting about this is, you know, as I think, When we thought about the election, especially relative to 2016, there was a lot of concern about the role that foreign organization would have in actually trying to drive misinformation. And a lot was done and said about the, you know, the role that Russia specifically played in the 2016 election, and the fear that the role that it could play in 2020. Right. What was interesting there is that what seemed to be the biggest threat was actually more domestic disinformation than anything Russia related. As a matter of fact, there was a report put out by the Washington Post last month that said that Russian government did not mount any major social media influence campaigns ahead of the 2020 election. Now, in part, could have been because there was it was such already top of mind to everyone. So the social platforms themselves were very aggressive mm-hmm. of not getting caught like they did the first time, Facebook included. Right. There was actually that. But part of what they said was part of the reason is because they felt that Americans were already doing a good job of, you know, for them of this internal misinformation, which is right. crazy. But there were some things. I mean, if we think about it, and like this is a part where I'm sure is there's definitely bias in my point of view here. But I do think about the level of misinformation that started with the president. Right. The amount of misinformation around mail-in voting, to your point, and never had it been done before to this degree. But to also treat it like it was a some mass fraud that immediately would happen because of it
for sure.
is ridiculous. When it's been used in plenty of states, and he's been using it for years. It's right there was that. Also, the such early signaling of well, accusation.
But one quick distinction though, because there is a difference between absentee ballots and mail-in ballots. So absentee ballots have been used for a long time, and mail-in have been
and
used
mail-in
for a
long,
long
both
time.
Both
of them have.
And in some states, is statewide, meaning right. they send it to everybody.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, yeah. But on this scale, and what I'm
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, in this scale, just, you're, yeah. you're entirely right. In this scale, you're right. It's first time at this scale. But the accusations, I think, that did not help in the cause, is, and I do believe from the
did
president.
Did not help.
Was that specifically making it immediately found like it was going to be fraud because of it. And this notion that of planting the seed that the election was somehow going to get stolen and that it was going to have to go to the Supreme Court. Now, this is something that President Trump has been talking about like since the summer. And I think it continues to build up. So there was already sort of the sort of the groundwork being laid to have a lot of mistrust in this election because of all these reasons. And I think when the numbers started to come in and people saw that literally like all early in the night, President Trump winning in a number of different places. And as they started to continue the count, they started to get in more of those mail-in ballots, which by the way, in many cases, they were pushing to not allow the states to be able to count them before election night. Right, and we could debate right or wrong of whether the case, but then the dynamic it creates is that if people that are sending in their mail-in ballots were more Democratic because the Democratic side of the aisle was much more encouraging of that process, then it's not necessarily a big surprise why you will see that kind of sway. But it all adds to this mix of a lot of distrust.
Yeah, there's no question that all of that, I look at it again, and you've heard me say this so many times, but you know, for the benefit of any or of the folks listening with respect to my thoughts on President Trump is that he's first and foremost the kind of business tycoon that I've had either the misfortune or fortune, depending on the circumstances, to know quite well. And people like that are always thinking what the next step is, right? So maybe I'm feeling like I'm actually a little bit behind in this race, either because Biden is really strong, which I doubt, but more because people really hate me. And as many as, you know, because that's who voted, people who hate him and people who love him, right? Nobody voted for Biden, besides his wife, maybe. And so he's feeling...
he's, I'm letting that one go, but yeah.
he's feeling like he's maybe going to lose. So now what's the next thing? Okay, well, I need to start maybe introducing or injecting some doubt into this right. so that when I make the next case, which is, hey, there were some irregularities here. We should run these out. And there were some irregularities. There were a number of very clear affidavits and different things, but those things have a process. And you go through them, you research them, right. and then if the courts take them up, in which case the Supreme Court did not, then you have that is the process. That's the end of the process. In fact, today, when the Electoral College voted, right. is the process. This is when you can officially say President-elect Biden because sure. they've voted to elect him. So all of that has a process. But my point is he kind of played that chess piece because that's what guys like this do. That's what guys like this do, in my opinion. I'm not saying it's right or wrong or good. I'm just saying that it's like, to me, it's not a surprise when I see something
like that. No, it's definitely
not
a surprise. But I think the level of doubt that it creates in the process, it's I think it's really damaging, frankly.
It is.
I think we're going to have years and years of this where all of a sudden the types of the rules of the game, I think, have changed to the degree that when a party loses, what people could actually push for. I mean, look, the last time we had a contested election was with Al Gore lost against
George W.,
right? And there, it never, I mean, that was a pretty fairly quick process if you think about what happened there. And it was over 550 votes in one state.
Well, quick, right? It was 38 days. It wasn't that quick. I mean, it was...
Correct. But if it was all centered on one state. And where there was an actual issue with the actual counting, that was the whole Chad situation. Remember
for sure,
that, right?
100%.
They had an issue. Yep. Or where the Supreme Court actually shut down the recount.
That's right.
And part of that actually was already shut down. Like the state itself didn't want to continue the recount because of the number of Republicans were protesting the process of recounting. And that was just like on one state. I mean, the scale of the number, and I was actually trying to find a count earlier today, the count of the number of lawsuits that have transpired since election, and it's like 50 plus, of which I believe at this point all have been lost by one. And I think the one that was won about is about being able to stand a little bit closer to actually seeing the election count, like nothing of actual consequence. And I understand the comment, look, when you have 160 million plus people voting, are you going to have some irregularities based on that many people across the percent? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anything, nowhere, there's nothing within that nowhere near in terms of fraud at scale, et cetera, which is why you keep on seeing these losses across the board. But there is all this doubt that's been painted. And the fact that we're still, like, as mm-hmm. of today, right, December 14, we're still like, is this now the final stage? How many more things have to go to the Supreme Court? Now we're worried about whether or not the House of Representatives is gonna all support what the Electoral College is gonna do or not. And there's already a lot of talk there. People that True. Want to undermine it at that level.
I think it's been amazing
to me that sure. this level of doubt for this long for someone that lost by so many electoral votes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
against so many different states, and still so much doubt.
Yeah,
right?
I agree, and I think that the fact that the Supreme Court didn't take it up, the fact that the largely to your point, the cases brought against the election have been, basically refuted or declined or whatever the combination is, I think attests to the legitimacy of the system that we have, and I think it's a yeah. good thing. And I think after today, when we can, you know, like see the process play out with the Electoral College and all that, I do believe that things will begin to kind of normalize. I don't think, though, that we can have this conversation without talking about the media, because in this study, that is clear as a bell, the media's kind of reaction to all of this, or not reaction, I'm sorry, the people's perception about
of the media. Can we talk, actually, let's talk about that a little bit, yeah, right? So a couple sure. of things, right, that came out. I agree with you. It's actually really surprising. One is 59% of Americans said that the news media was responsible. And responsible meaning that they did a good job in its reporting of the election results and outcome.
59%
overall, right? So almost two-thirds, right? Mm-hmm. Of that, it was 93% of Democrats and then 21% of Republicans, right? So you can once again see a really big difference in terms of how they each felt, how responsible the media was in the election right. outcome. What's more interesting is how their view of the news sources actually changed before
right.
election.
That was even funnier.
That's the funniest part yeah. of this thing. I'm like, okay, so the
Democrats thought they were even more responsible.
Exactly, right? That sounds great. So one is like Republicans' opinions of cable news coverage of the elections saw the largest decrease, right? Moving from 45% being considered excellent or good mm-hmm. before the elections to about 29% being post-elections, right? So from 45 to 29, which is a pretty big drop, right?
Right.
Conversely, of course, Democrats went from 61% to 73%. So right. it's almost like when you're trying to do a judgment of like how good was the refereeing of a game, right?
Oh yeah, it depends on whether or not my team won.
If you won the game, your team won. They were terrible. Right. They missed every right. call. Yeah. It's like, I mean, in some ways, it's such human nature
that,
when you see
that
this.
Is. That
and,
is.
But it was to me kind of hilarious. But I also think, and like now, without being funny, I think a lot of it has to do with what I believe the President Trump has done in terms of really turning on anyone that has gone against him, including Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if anything, he's definitely created that. I think this is in part a result of that, of really going after anyone that disagrees with him. I mean, look, I was trying to remember what was the name of the person who was in charge of elections under his administration. Who talked about it as being one of the safest and more secure presidential elections.
Krebs was his last name. I only remember that because we have an right. associate named Krebs as well.
And him getting fired, right? Today, yeah. It came out today that President Trump just announced that Will Barr is going to be leaving.
He's
right?
resigned, yeah.
That he's resigned. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason why that's important is because, you know, he set an investigation for the DOJ to look into these irregularities, came back and said, no, we couldn't find anything. And of course, President Trump was not happy about that, and the speculation was that he's going to be gone because of it.
Right.
And a guy who, by the way, by all accounts and by anyone that is on the other side of the conversation, felt that this guy was, you know, like right there hand in hand with President
right.
Trump
to
do his
right his bidding. Right.
His bidding. Right. Thank you.
But
will the
media now turn around and say, you know what, we may have been wrong, because now he's resigned and he's very principled and whatever.
That's right. Right. So is he principled because he went against him, or is he?
That's my point. My point in talking about the media is that they have a big role to play in this. Okay, I mean, we could talk about a number of different things. The Hunter Biden story. So it turns out Hunter Biden actually is being investigated for a number of different things.
Which he didn't want to make public, right? Because
and that's fine. Look,
but I guess according to the DOJ, what they said there is that they don't want to make public any kind of investigation that may directly affect a political process, right?
So makes sense.
That's a case where like, okay, that makes sense. Which puts him in a very different light than what.
But it was exactly, it was his Justice Department saying that, coming to that conclusion that we don't want to politicize this, so we're not going to pursue it. Where Trump would have said, no, pursue it. It's going to help me.
Well, I think that's the reason why he's gone though.
Well, okay, but what I'm saying is he can't be the evil ogre and a principled, whatever.
I agree with you.
Enforcer of the law at the same time.
And I think that's what makes this whole thing so complicated, right?
I also think
that's the little that it takes, or a lot, but maybe the better way to say it, how quickly things can turn for anyone that disagrees with the president.
Yeah, agreed.
I think it's as quick as that. It's like you can be his best friend. Because the thing that gets seared in my mind is Will Barr walking with President Trump to the church to be able to take a photo op as they had just finished just like basically dispersing everyone and throwing things at them and getting rid of peaceful protesters to be able to go take a picture. And I remember seeing him like, I would have never thought to ever see that, where you have the head of the DOJ walking with them and it's something that's a very political moment.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the same guy who also, to your point, at the same time, had decided he was not going to make public this investigation that was happening to the son of the rival of President Trump.
Despite the fact that it would have been hugely beneficial, because as it turns out, I've seen some of the stats, and a good chunk
It's crazy.
It's very crazy, and a good chunk of Biden eventual supporters were not aware of any of that kind of Biden story. Sure. Let me give you one other example, though, because I think this is even more germane about the media's responsibility and what I think drives some of these numbers. So today is significant because obviously the Electoral College voted. We now officially have president-elect. And look, it's a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking, but we really should only call president-elects when they've been elected by the Electoral College. Like, that should have applied to Trump. It should apply to everybody. There should be a prospect or a presumed winner until you're the president-elect, until you're the president. Like, we should follow that process. Suddenly, we've let the media declare Trump is the president-elect, Bush is the president-elect. There's a process to actually elect the president.
But it's not suddenly, though, Charlie, right?
Because it's December 14th, that's my point.
No. Meaning that process has, and look, it could have been the case maybe before I can remember as, a child, I'm sure maybe before that, where it wasn't the case, to your point, where they would wait until the Electoral College actually officially said this is the president-elect. But from what I could ever remember in any presidential election that I've been alive for, it's always been called the second that the states are called, that becomes the president-elect.
I didn't look this up, but my guess is that it's of more recent vintage than you think, that idea. Maybe in the last, 30 years, which is, in a country that's been around for 250, it's not that long.
Yeah.
Anyway, my point is that we actually have a process to determine the president-elect, the electors vote. Today is the 14th, we have that. So here's the other thing that happened today, the 14th, is that we have a vaccine for the coronavirus, right? Mm-hmm. Pfizer's out with the vaccine. Now, I thought about that Pfizer coming out with the vaccine in the context of what this study tells us about media and people feeling that they've been misinformed and all this other stuff. So I went back and I looked, just because we've kind of joked about it, but I went back and I looked at a couple of examples about how the media responded when President Trump said that the vaccine would come before the end of the year. Here's one from August, from NPR. NPR in August said, quote, President Trump again said widespread distribution of a vaccine against the coronavirus would happen before the end of the year, directly contradicting Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Robert Redfield, right? So they're basically saying he's completely going against the CDC and suggesting that that won't actually happen. Now, you can say, well, no, that was in reference to widespread distribution. Well, today in New York today on the 14th, received 72,000 doses, and before the end of the year will receive another 500,000 doses. Mm-hmm. Just New York, right? So maybe you don't call that widespread, but it's approaching availability, right? Here's the other
approaching
one.
Approaching a billion, as you like to say.
Approaching a billion. So here's another one from NBC back in May.
Yeah.
This says, President Donald Trump has suggested that a coronavirus vaccine could come within months. Remember, this is May. Mm-hmm. And prominent health experts and veteran vaccine developers say that is unlikely absent a miracle. Okay, his quote says, this is Trump, I think we're going to have a vaccine by the end of the year. And then NBC goes on to say, but experts say that the development, testing, and production of a vaccine for public is still 12 to 18 months off, and that anything less would be a medical miracle. And here we are on December 14th with a vaccine. Right. So all that I'm saying is that we can't, like, the media has gotten really, I think, like their emotions are showing over the last little bit. And my hope is with this Biden administration, because as I've joked with you before, like now we have a president that is like other presidents, super boring and nobody cares about. So like hopefully the media can go back to actually doing their job of reporting on journalism. But I think that they've got a big part to play in all of this mistrust that's out there among the people that are the electorate.
Right. And I think the part that I struggle with, because I definitely see your point, and I think there is truth to what you're saying. But when I recall how President Trump handled these situations, and more specifically how his own behavior, his own comments undermine his own efforts, is I really have a hard time feeling sorry for him, right? When he publicly puts pressure to the head of the FDA to approve or saying that they're stalling and approving the vaccine to hurt his presidential election, it makes everyone feel like then you're just rushing through the process.
Right,
to
we're
the
not
point where
take
all
it.
These guys from a number of these different pharmaceuticals came out and said, hey, we're not rushing anything. We're going to take all the steps that we need to. Now, they were rushing, but to the point is we're going to take the steps required to actually get there. Now, one of the things that I thought about in kind of remembering about the process that they did for the vaccine is one of the factors that I think this probably doesn't get talked about enough is that in previous vaccine process, which all I think the average was like 4 years was the fastest, which I think part of the reason why they said that it was going to take at least, you know, if you cut that in half is amazing, is that it was those trials just took a lot longer.
Right.
And in part because it was a lot harder for people to naturally catch these infections. Right, because especially when something can be deadly, they're not trying to just give it to them. Now, in this case, there was such a high infection in a lot of different areas that people were just catching much faster. So therefore,
it was easier.
The trial process actually accelerated because of that, which is a really interesting dynamic if you think about that, right?
There's a lot of money at stake, and there's a lot.
Sure, right? So, and also the fact that they started so quickly, right? Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of maybe early on, if you may recall, some press that was put out actually recognizing a lot of the doctors in China for actually documenting and sharing that broadly with the medical community of the actual the gene code of this disease that allowed everyone to start working on a vaccine right away, right? So that also kind of helped you know move the process forward. But you're right, there's so much mistrust. I'm sorry, with President Trump and what he says. But in part because you have these two versions. You have Operation Warp Speed, where even if you think it's a hilarious name like I do, there was actually some really good things that were done with that, right? When you think about it, some real bets that, hey, we're going to, no matter what, like we're going to just place bets. We're going to order some of these.
Sure, we're going to hack the
process. We're going to hack the process so that the second it gets approved, it's already going out because mm-hmm. you don't have to sort of start production at that point. That's great. Mm-hmm. And then undermine that with, yeah, but they're not trying to get this approved to undermine my election. So you're like in this constant struggle saying that, hey, don't worry about this, thing is just going to go away. At the same time as we're putting all this effort and time resources to get this going. And I think that's what creates that
it does.
That mistrust and
it does.
Everything seems like it comes from a political standpoint.
Sure.
Which is kind of hard not to see it that way when it comes from him.
And I don't, you know, you said that that makes it, despite what I said may have been true, it makes it very hard for you to feel sorry for Trump. Nobody's suggesting we should feel sorry for Trump. All that I'm suggesting is that the media's emotions have been worn on their sleeves for a while. And I think that has added to people feeling like they don't know which way is up. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
That's all I'm saying.
You know, the other thing that I looked at, Charlie, and kind of figuring out this timeline, right? Because I was thinking, what was happening November 9th, right? It's actually amazing because so much has happened in this time, mm-hmm. right? I went back and looked at November 9th. I'll give you just a quick readout of everything that was happening around the elections or November 9th, right? So we said it already. It was actually really interesting looking at this. We talked about that at that point, the race had been called for Joe Biden because of the four states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Wisconsin had been already called, the three states, I guess. Arizona was still out. Although
and Georgia was still out, right?
Georgia was still out in Arizona because Georgia did multiple recounts, right? Yeah. And Arizona was still sort of going through that process, although it had been called by Fox News and the AP at that point. Also during that at that time is Attorney General Will Barr had authorized the DOJ to investigate allegations of voting irregularities. Something that, by the way, the Director of Elections Crime Branch, literally the person who's responsible for looking at these kind of allegations of voting irregularities, quit because of that. right? He like left and like, forget it. I'm out of here. If you're going to do this because there's no proof, etc. Of course, since then we know that they came back, so they didn't find anything. And now, you know, Will Barr is gone because of it. In Georgia, the two Republican senators, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, who, by the way, are both in this Senate runoff race, both were calling for the resignation of the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, right, who's also Republican, for failures, once again, without any evidence, of his management of the election. So you have state senators calling out their, basically, state representatives out of the race of the elections. In the media, Fox News had cut away from the White House press secretary, Kelly McKinney, as she was throwing out
McEnany,
thank you. Yeah. Because she was throwing out more of these claims about voter fraud. Fox News, once again, actually cut away from it because they said, like, we can't even show this anymore. It's gotten so bad. And what was most interesting to me, the last point, is that it was literally in the news that Senator Susan Collins from Maine had become the fourth elected Republican to formally recognize President-elect Joe Biden. Fourth one. And I would love to say that that has changed a lot since a month ago, November 9th, right? It's actually over a month.
I think
it is not the case.
I think the
important, and that is so sad.
Yeah, I think the important thing is what happens tomorrow on December 15th, right? Because the Electoral College has done their constitutional duty, and let's see what happens after that.
I think, by the way, the last piece on the data, which I think is really interesting. Have you said everything that we just talked about? How
I have one more important thing on this.
Okay.
You're probably going to the same thing.
Yeah, I think so. Which is one of the points that came out is basically there's still a lot of interest in hearing others' opinion.
That's what I was going
to say. Right, which is in some ways it's really great to hear. I'm very jaded when I hear that, because how much people really want to actually hear the people's opinion. But the solid majorities across party lines perceive the nation as greatly divided, and they'll most say they're interested in learning about the opinions of those with whom they disagree politically. So you have somehow along the middle of all this confusion, all the disagreement, all this partisan sort of point of view, this interest of wanting to hear more of the other person's opinion, that especially with people that disagree with them politically. And I don't know how much to believe that, to be honest. I don't know if that's the kind of thing that people say.
But I think in the context of this study, you have to believe it to the same degree you believe the other statistics in this study. I mean, it's like, you know, these are the same people answering the same questions. And so we have to at least consider it to the same degree of veracity as the other stuff. But I found that very interesting as well. I actually cut it out in my notes that a quarter of all Americans answered that they have a great deal of interest in learning about the opinions of people who they disagree with politically. A quarter of all Americans, about 23% of Democrats, about 34% of independents, and about 20% of Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And then the degree to which they say a fair amount they want to learn about it is still like in the 50s.
It's the majority,
for everybody.
Across the board.
And pretty consistent among these different groups. So I think that's huge. Frankly, as a business person, I look at a graph like this and I see dollar signs. Because I think that, like, that's the reason we did this podcast. Because right. I think that this is emblematic of the fact that people have a hunger for really understanding a variety of different points of views, but we haven't had the opportunity to hear them.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, creates a pretty interesting business opportunity.
You know, a few episodes ago, you asked me the question, I think in this, as we were having this conversation, is what I thought it would take in order for us to kind of get off of this very heated moment in the political environment. And I mentioned to you then, this is, I think, right before the election, is that I just didn't see how that could happen with President Trump continuing to be president.
Yep.
And I even in seeing that, I feel even more strongly about that point. And at least, look, we could disagree whether or not, to what degree people voted for President-elect Biden for him or versus against Trump,
mm-hmm.
which I probably more in your camp than not in terms of very much in a vote against Trump. At the same time, I think there is an opportunity to just bring down the volume a little bit, bring down the heat a little bit.
For sure.
And I hope this actually does happen, right? Because while I see this, I can be very skeptical of this. It's kind of, I put a comment like this in the category of, you know, people that when it comes to the new year say, oh, this is the year that I'm going to go out and get in shape and work out. And the things that we all kind of wish happen and say, but it always worries me that it's just talk. At the same time, if it is real, if people really do want to actually get more to a middle ground, I hope that actually does happen.
I do too. And I think that, you know, I agree with your assessment that something, you know, massive has to change in order for us to have that reset opportunity so that we can get, you know, into these spaces and places where we can have this dialogue. So I do agree with that. And I hope that this is it. And I hope that the, you know, journalism and political parties kind of go to their rightful corners where we've had them for a while and maybe stay there for a bit so that we can have this discussion. One last stat, which I did think was interesting, is the assessment of the people in the survey in terms of their perspectives on how internet companies addressed misinformation. Because I think that was another one that was like showed this massive divide. So what it basically said is that, and the question was specifically, do you think that Facebook and Google and all these companies went too far, were about right, or didn't go far enough in trying to prevent the spread of false information?
I already know what the answer is.
Well, but here's the thing, right? So just like the Republicans have this mass over index on these questions, here Americans overall, a third of them, Americans overall, said that these platforms had gone too far. Mm-hmm. And 25% said we're doing about right, okay? Independents, 40% said they went too far. Republicans, 66% said they went too far. Democrats, the number's so small I can't even read it. In terms of them thinking that...
It's 2%.
Actually. It's like, it's literally...
No, it's actually 2%.
Is it really?
It's 2%.
Okay, it's 2%. That's a big swing. It's like, no, it's Facebook and Google, they're just fine.
Doing awesome.
Just great.
But that goes right in line to what we talked about last week, right? Which is this, I think it was last week, where we talked about this notion that, you know, many conservatives feel that their voice are the ones that are being stifled by these internet companies. And by the way, this kind of actually helps make that point, both from both the Republicans or the conservative side and the liberal side.
So
this is a level of sort of disagreement and or agreement, depending on where you sit in the...
So does it mean that just the Democrats are just that much more vindictive? Because even though they only have 2% that say that the internet companies did a bad thing, they nevertheless, they agree that they're the worst problem in our entire society. So it's like...
Right.
So
right,
like at the same time, they're awful, but they didn't screw up on the election misinformation.
I still think that, because I think both things actually hold true, is that there is mass distrust. Mistrust. And at the same time, feeling that they didn't, you know, to some extent is like they, you know, were about right. It still is like the biggest issue here is that 60% said they didn't go far enough. That's their biggest issue. They still feel that there's too many fringe voices are going up, putting this conspiracy theory. So the mistrust is for a different reason. Mm. And the mistrust is for not policing enough some of these extreme voices. Where for the conservative side, the mistrust comes from feeling that they're being overly policed.
Yeah.
But the outcome is the same.
Right.
They still feel like
these companies are
in the wrong position.
For sure. Okay. Well,
we could go on that one for a while, but I think it's a good stop.
Yeah. Look, I think that here on December 14th, leading to hopefully tomorrow when people, you know, begin to recognize and speak in the right way about President-elect Biden, I think we have an opportunity to bring this thing back together. But again, the big thing for me coming out of all of this, it seems that people want to hear about stuff that they don't necessarily agree with, and we need to create those spaces and places, and so I'm happy about that.
Great.
All right. Shake it off. We have to create like a new a segment to just shake it off. All right. Courage or cringe? So we've got a hodgepodge of stuff in here.
Yeah.
Where do we start with Governor Northam, I think?
Yeah, so Virginia Governor Northam announced some new coronavirus restrictions on this past Thursday, I guess of last week. And as part of this, asked Virginians of faith to practice health precautions when attending church services, right? Assuring them that they do not have to sit in the church pew for God to hear your prayers. So, and I quote, he mentioned, "This is a holy time for multiple faith traditions. Christmas is 2 weeks away. The holidays are typical times of joy and community. We gather together, we celebrate our faith, and we celebrate with family." And he continued, "But this year we need to think about what is truly the most important thing. Is it the worship or the building? For me, God is wherever you are. You don't have to sit in the church pew for God to hear your prayers. And worship with a mask on is still worship. Worship outside or worship online is still worship." Now, the reason why he's talking about all these things is in part the governor is blaming at least some of the spread of the virus in Virginia to some congregations that he said acted carelessly in observing the faith and precautions, saying that while most churches across the state had done the right thing, and I quote, right, some have failed to social distance and wear a mask. Now, having said all that, the governor is not imposing additional restrictions on house of worship. as part of these new state restrictions. Now, some of that comes directly from what happened in New York, which is the Supreme Court there ruled in favor of several New York churches and synagogues that challenged some of the pandemic restrictions on religious services. Now, that's a topic that was heating up over the summer. Mm-hmm. And you had a number of these churches that were pushing back on Governor Cuomo specifically over there, right? And some of the policies they put in place in terms of not being able to attend. And but there's been a lot of back and forth. I mean, there's been a number of different articles that have come out that actually talk about what they believe are some of these hotspots that were created because of some of this, not just churches getting together, but getting together without social distancing, without masks, et cetera. And then you have now this dynamic in the Supreme Court coming and saying, wait a minute, like they have the rights as well. And you can't just go on and sort of stop people from being able to gather in order to pray. So thoughts on that? Obviously, it's an interesting one, right? Because he's trying to use faith ideology to be able to make his case of why it's actually not needed to be there. And which ultimately is a message about, people being careful. But what is, as someone definitely with deep faith, what was your reaction to seeing these kind of comments come out of the governor of Virginia?
Well, so for me, I mean, I'll start with the end in mind. So it was definitely cringe for a couple of different reasons. I think the issue with the First Amendment or the discussion around the First Amendment is whether or not, as it relates to religion, the First Amendment allows us to actually worship in a space or whether it allows us to live our faith wherever we are. Because there's a big point of view about that, right? It's like, oh yeah, if you go in
that's a good way to distinguish it. Yeah, I like that.
There's people who think that if you they're fine with it so long as you do it in your building, but the moment it's out here, then I've got other things to say. And there's people who say, like, wait a minute, I live my faith wherever I am, and so the First Amendment should apply to my practice of the faith wherever it happens to be. You wouldn't be surprised I find myself in the latter camp, not the former. But anyway, the big thing for me that was the kind of, the thing that made it cringy for me was that, that Governor Northam, and I have no idea what this man's faith is or whether or not he has one. I have no clue. But
I think based on his comment, I have to imagine he's fairly religious, I would think. Because if he wasn't at all, and this comes out, like, that's very odd to me.
I don't know. But he's making some theological terms about where God is, where God isn't, what we need, what we don't.
He literally says, for me, God is everywhere.
Right, of course.
Is wherever you are. Like, so that's what I'm saying. Like, I think
for sure.
But if someone wasn't religious, like, I would have a hard time.
I believe he is religious. My point is, I don't know what kind of faith tradition he has. I don't know if he's a Protestant, whatever he is. I have no idea. But anyway, my point is that, as you've said before, people that are in positions of authority and power, CEOs and otherwise, when they speak,
it matters.
It matters, right? Yeah. So here you have the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia basically saying that, look, the way that I view God, he's kind of everywhere. So you don't need to worry about sitting in the pew and you don't need to worry about this other stuff. It's really about God is wherever you happen to be. Now, that may be fine and dandy for him. And, from a theological standpoint, I would say you're right. God is everywhere because, of course, God made everything. So clearly he can be everywhere. But there is a value to community. There is a value to liturgy. There is a value to symbols. There is a value to the church building and icons and stained glass windows and altars and all the things that remind us of our faith. And so to just say, hey, hey, you don't need those things because God doesn't really care, which is kind of how I read it, is a very, anti sort of sacramental kind of view of the world, which is fine. It's his opinion. My cringe comes as this is the governor of a commonwealth, right? So like we're imposing these restrictions, but, and we're going to ask you guys to do better because really you don't need to be in a church in order to worship God. And that's where it was like, it just kind of started going into this overreach area that concerns me because frankly, like I don't want these guys saying how people should worship and I don't think that it's their job to do so. So for me, it was a cringe.
Yeah. I mean, I get that. It's a tricky one because on the one hand, he's trying to walk a very fine line of trying to be prescriptive of what he truly believes is needed in order to try to curb the spread of the virus, et cetera, and talking about it in the context of faith without coming out more aggressively and saying, hey, you should not do this. You should not be in person at a church without a mask, et cetera. So trying to find the right way. So I think what he was trying to do is make it very personal. And that's why I have to imagine that he's religious. To your point, we don't know what he actually is. I could definitely see the issue with it. I could see someone like anyone that's very religious having issue with how he talks about this. But ultimately, what he said, I didn't find anything that wrong in what he said specifically. which is why I put it more on the courage side, because he's trying to find a, in what I thought was middle of the road approach to try to encourage people to, while you still practice, we just want you to be safer. And sort of remind people that you also, like, just because you're not in, in your church doesn't mean that you're no longer, religious, or that God is going to be upset with you. I'm obviously making up words here.
Sure.
Not exactly what he said, but I take it more from that standpoint and trying to find a sort of a middle ground of saying this and using his personal faith. I wish I knew a little bit more about what his actual personal faith was, because depending on him personally, if he's a very religious person, I think then this is more courage than less courage. If he's not religious at all, by the way, if he's not religious and he says this, 100% courage.
Yeah.
Like, then what are you talking about?
I mean, I could,
but if
be,
he's someone I, that is like very yeah. religious, I could actually give him a little bit of credit of trying to use his personal faith as a way to communicate this, because he's not discouraging people from not getting together. He's just saying, simply saying that, just know that you could still be a practicing whatever,
right?
And do these things and still be safe and still try to do the things that you can to make sure that we are able to curb this pandemic.
My guess is that, and this is a guess, but I'll try to confirm it before our next show. My guess is that he's probably Christian. And he's probably one, a faith tradition, sort of non-Catholic Christian. So like a Baptist or, you know, some kind of thing like that. That'd be my guess. And, you know, and again, I think that his opinions are fine in the context of issuing a decree, and then consequently, not just issuing a decree, but also laying a little bit of blame on you know, religious congregations. I think it has that vibe of overreach. It definitely made me uncomfortable because, again, I feel like, you know, secular government is one thing, and if you want to be like a pastor or religious leader or something, great, go for it. But, you know, never the twain shall meet, and I think that's enshrined in our Constitution. Mm-hmm. So it just really bugged me.
Yeah.
Not because it wasn't offensive what he said necessarily. It wasn't even that. It was just like, where, if you kind of follow the puck, like where it goes, I was like, I don't want to go there. That's the reason why I gave it a courage.
And I think that's why I gave it a courage, simply because I didn't think that what he said specifically, he was trying to be offensive. I think the way he said it was actually pretty, once again, trying to find a middle ground and saying this without making it like an actual decree or policy here that you have to do.
Yep.
So that's probably the reason why I'm more on the courage side.
Okay, very good. So we're batting 500. As usual, you start us off in complete disagreement, Jesus. Good job. All right. So what's next?
Goya. So we talked about Goya.
A
number of times a while ago.
El Sazón.
So I thought it was, frankly, made me laugh when I saw this headline. That's why I wanted to talk about it. I like talking about things that
trolls.
Make me laugh.
Trolls.
So Goya CEO Robert Unanue referred to Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as the company's, and I put in quotes, employee of the month.
Ouch.
Claiming that the Congresswoman's July tweets about making her own adobo boosted sales, right? Yeah.
This was on a conservative podcast, right?
Yeah, I think so. He was being interviewed, right? So basically, and I quote what he said, is that when she boycotted us, mm-hmm. our sales actually increased 1,000%, right? That's what he said during a podcast or in an interview in the Michael Berry show, which you tell me. I actually never heard of the Michael Berry
I never
show.
Heard of him either.
Then he continued to say, she got employee of the month for bringing attention to Goya and our adobo. He had it referring to obviously the company's popular seasoning mix. Adobo is a type of mix that people use and a lot of different types of meats, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is here is that they're a private company, so none of their sales figures are actually public. But it was interesting him sort of placing both the blame and credit, I guess, to her in helping drive sales. And on Tuesday, Ocasio-Cortez tweeted that she didn't call for a boycott. Her original tweet was part of a backlash that Goya faced. By the way, across the board, it wasn't just Alexandria Cortez that actually, pushed back. It was a bunch of people.
We've covered this on the show before.
Yeah, right. That basically happened in the summer after Unanue. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, Unanue.
Unanue spoke at the White House praising President Donald Trump. And he had been, by the way, invited to the White House as part of this administration Hispanic Prosperity Initiative, which, and we talked about this before, initiative that got completely like overlooked because that moment kind of took over the entire thing where they were actually recognizing some of the Hispanic basically folks in industry and the work that they've done there. Right. The other thing, just to finish off on him specifically, is days after the speech, Unanue went to on Fox News and said that he was not apologizing for his statements, and he called the ensuing boycott movement suppression of speech, right? So he was pretty firm in his stance. And you kind of saw both things. You saw people that were very quickly jumped on that and said, we're boycotting Goya because of this. And you had a number of people looking up their own seasoning, looking at literally promoting competing products. And then you also saw, and by the way, in my own personal network, I saw people immediately step up and say, no, 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 like we're not going to try to undermine the Latino business leader, Latino business. And we're even more supportive of him now because of this. So I actually, in my own, once again, we talk about living in echo chambers, right? But in my own personal network, I actually saw both camps. I saw a camp that was immediately,
well, because you have,
I saw a camp that was, and by the way, the camp that was for him was definitely a Florida camp. That was probably more of my Republican friends who were very aggressively pushing to support his point of view.
But you had multiple dynamics in the sense that even if you disagreed with him, you didn't want to like necessarily penalize a Latino business.
Yeah, sure.
And a Latino employer too, because they employ thousands of people.
I just love the trolling employee of the month. Frankly, that's the reason I want to talk about it because I think it's hilarious.
Do you want to go first on this?
No, I mean, go ahead.
Okay, so and this may surprise you. I give this one a cringe, and the reason for it, I mean, look, and I didn't listen to the whole show. So I'm not, I did listen to the clip when he actually mentioned this. So it is admittedly out of context. Who knows what they were talking about? They could have been talking about something for a half hour and then suddenly this came up. But my point is, this is a little bit of old news. It's a little bit of old news. So it's like this happened back in June, July. It's a little bit of picking a fight.
Yeah.
For no reason. You've got a private company, and the private company, you can't verify. He said 1,000% increase. That's weird. Like right. What? Like that just sounds like it's an exaggeration. Like you would say it went up 342.
He reminds you of somebody.
Sounds great. Sounds awesome. Approaching a million. Approaching a billion. But no, my point.
I was actually talking about Trump, but
oh, just sorry. Thought you were talking about him. My point is that if you had a percentage, you would say, "Hey, you know what? Our sales increased by 347%."
Right.
To say it went up by 1,000, it's just weird. So I'm not sure I believe it. I think he was just saying that he was kind of making the point that like, "Hey, we had a lot of sales. Great. Okay." But you're kind of picking a fight. It's kind of old news. You're kind of doing it to get attention. It feels a little bit like creepy uncle to me. It does. It's just like, it's a little weird. And look, now at the same time, I went back and I read the tweets that AOC did. I know she didn't use the word boycott, but when you say, you know, I'm now going to look up how to make adobo on Google instead of going and buying the product.
Sure.
The inference is I'm no longer buying your products.
Oh, for
also sure. Also known as a boycott. So for her to say, I never called for a boycott is so lame. But I
agree with you.
But, I think that on the whole, given all the circumstances, this one for me is a cringe.
Great. I mean, look, I think I agree with you 100%. I mean, look, it's interesting in this case is that I think to your point, having this the CEO of Goya come out and talk about this when you're a private company, I don't understand what the end goal is of bringing that up, right?
Six months later,
and by the way, putting it all specifically on her, on Ocasio-Cortez, right? Because it wasn't just her. Let's be honest; like her is probably the most subtle of the boycott calls. Maybe she doesn't want to recognize it as a boycott, but it definitely kind of sounds like it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that actually disagree with what he said. A lot of his own consumers that didn't disagree with what he said. Now, if that net increase or the net result was an actual increase in sales, great. Good for you. Like, that's awesome.
She's got 8.5 million followers on Instagram, though. So let's not underestimate her power to be a...
I agree. But it wasn't just because of her. It wasn't her alone. She's not the one that started. There was an immediately outcry from a lot of people as it relates to this comment. This was immediately controversial, right? Mm-hmm. And it was controversial because of what he said, not because Ocasio-Cortez complained about it.
Mm-hmm.
She was immediately tied to it right away because of her comments.
Right.
But to bring it up now and to try to troll her because of this, it seems like you're just, like, I agree with you. Actually, I think it's a really, really good way to describe it. You're picking a fight for no real reason that ultimately, I don't know how that helps you win. And I don't know how that helps you get better with your current consumer base.
It doesn't ingratiate you with really anybody. I mean, look, I'm sure they had good sales or whatever. I don't think it was 1,000%. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, it doesn't add anything to the conversation. Yeah. And so
I agree. All right. So we agree.
Wow, that's there awesome. We go. Back to 500. Thank you. All right, so we got one more.
The Cleveland, soon to no longer be called Indians. The Cleveland Indians.
The baseball players formerly known as Indians. Yeah. Yes.
So the Cleveland Indians are dropping their name after 105 years.
Sheesh.
So the team could stop using the Indians' name as soon as the 2022 season. So not next year, but the following year. Now, Cleveland retired the use of his former cartoon mascot known as Chief Wahoo after the 2018 season.
That was the famous face on the baseball caps and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Immortalized in the movie Major League, which is
the slightly racist looking face. Mm-hmm. And that was always all over their uniforms.
Do you remember that movie from the
80s? Yeah.
Just a Bit Outside. Yes, Bob Uecker.
Yes, I do remember that very well. With Charlie Sheen.
That's
the guy from Blade.
Wesley Snipes.
Yep. Yeah.
And something Behringer. I forget his name.
So the NFL was, and by the way, this is part of a broader movement, right? I mean, we've seen this year alone, the NFL franchise known as now the Washington Football Team, which was before the Washington Redskins, decided to change their name and literally couldn't come up with a new name, so they just called the football team. So I think it's great. But they're actually doing pretty well, which is kind of interesting, you know? So maybe sometimes you need to get rid of that to be better. But unlike Washington, the baseball team for Cleveland is going to keep its current name while it determines what a new one will be, right? Now, there are other professional sports teams that have Native American terms in their names and imagery. So examples of that would be the Atlanta Braves, the Chicago Blackhawks, and the Kansas City Chiefs.
The Chiefs.
All of which have still recently stated that they have no plans to change their name. So.
You go first.
Cleveland Indians.
No. You go first.
I think the Cleveland Indians, honestly, in my mind, is this is probably one that is long overdue. I think the biggest offense was their mascot.
Mm-hmm.
That cartoonish looking, like it reminds me, you know what it reminded me of their mascot of the old Bugs Bunny cartoons? Like, I swear that same face Speedy Gonzalez. I have someone call me Speedy Gonzalez before. And I
really?
Was, in business.
You kick him in the balls?
And it's funny because they thought it was funny. And I looked at him like, and it was a moment of, okay, maybe I've kind of stepped on it. But I didn't even respond to it. But I had one person say that to me.
Who says that?
It's just so ridiculous, right? But it is, I mean, I think that's actually part of the reason why I think it's long overdue is that these things do influence culture. They influence how we think about it. They normalize things that we should be not normalizing, right? So having that kind of cartoon mascot of this, like, you know, character with a super large nose, very red face, that is obviously a cartoon. And once again, it's probably more indicative of a old Bugs Bunny cartoon from the 50s or before that. Not great. But that happened before today, though.
I mean, That did.
But I see it as sort of part of a progression where it kind of started with that and now is ending with the name Indians. And frankly, I have probably a little bit less issue with the name Indians. Having said that, you know, we know from history that it's actually not really the right term anyway, right? I mean, why that came about, right? And you know, when they came here thinking that they had gone to India, and that's why they call people, you know, folks as Indians, like that name kind of got stuck since then. So to move away from it now, I think it moves it to a better place. I like it. I like being getting rid of it. I think the fact that it takes so long for some of these things, you know, to take place is kind of amazing to me in this day and age. But I do put that in a different category than some of these other ones. Now, I'll be the first to admit I'm not versed enough into some of these other categories. But when I think about some of the different tribes and their names of the tribes are used as the actual mascot or something that could be more as a position of strength rather than a position of racism or making fun of someone. So when I think of Redskins versus Blackhawks, I put those in completely different categories, right? Blackhawks being a tribe, Redskins being a nickname of a group. So in the same case that you have the San Diego Aztecs? I forget what it is in college football. It's one of them, right? That has the Aztecs. One of them has it.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know.
So to me, it'd be like that. It's calling someone the Aztecs versus the Wetbacks. Significant difference. Now, they could be speaking about the same people, but I put them in very different category. Now, if we had someone that was Native American here with us, they would feel very different. I don't know, right? And frankly, part of my point of view would be, like, well, let's ask people that are actually them, and let's ask them how they feel about it.
Yes, thank you.
But ask...
And a wide swath of them, not just one.
Right, because that's part of the problem, right, is that sometimes these things get... You know, driven by a single person or not. But that's why I put this more in the courage. Not even courage. I put it cringe that it took so long.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of applaud them for the move, you know, even if it took them a while.
It's funny that you say that about the Blackhawk versus the Chiefs or something like that, right? The distinction there being that we're identifying a given tribe and we're raising that tribe up and we're giving that tribe some visibility and some love, as opposed to maybe trying to cash in on something that's a bit of a novelty, right? I think that's the sort of distinction that you were trying to make.
No, I'm distinguishing, especially in the case of Redskins, a clear racist term.
Yeah.
Versus the actual name of a tribe or something where you're recognizing them because of who they are. So that's why I will make the distinction between Aztecs will be a good one. I think I want to say the San Diego Aztec. I think it's for college football. San Diego State maybe is one of those. Versus calling someone the Wetbacks. Like, I will have an issue with that.
See what I'm saying?
Like, that would be kind of a problem.
San Diego State. Yeah. And by the way, so anyway, my point in bringing that up is I agree with you. I think that the idea of just having this very generic, very kind of marketing, sort of very, you know, again, it's like the sombreros or the, you know, the arepas. It's like so distant and kind of like we're going to try to find that one word that maybe we know and we're going to try to cash in on it is different than actually a tribe name or something that's really trying to elevate and raise it up. Now, having said that, the Washington football team is still called the Washington football team. And my fear is that they become some other thing that loses the opportunity to actually raise up Native American people. Because say what you want about the Redskins name, nevertheless, it at least oriented your mind to the fact that they were Native Americans. Now the Washington football team does nothing. It's this generic, vanilla. And by the way, yes, they're leading the NFC East, but like they have a 6-7 record and they're on top of that league. It's not like they're great, okay? But they're on top of their league because the entire league is terrible.
The division is terrible.
But my point is that, like, I really hope they do become the Washington, you know, Sioux.
But you think the Redskins name raised Native Americans?
My point is the Washington football team does nothing about Native Americans.
I mean, it's so half-baked is the problem.
Fine.
Right?
That's my point. And the person, what I understand about the Redskins, even though that's not what this Courage or Cringe is about, but the Redskins logo and all that stuff, and there was Native Americans that were involved in those decisions. So, like, but anyway, my point is that now they went from having something that was offensive to many, to some not, but whatever, it was offensive to many, to now this generic name. And my hope is that they go back and do something that honors Native Americans.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think they will. I think they'll call themselves the four leaf clovers or something.
This is really a point of issue for so many years. And you tell me that you never thought about what an alternate name could have been.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, screw it. We're changing the name. What's a new name? I have no idea. We'll figure it out next year. Like, what? So from that stuff, at least you can say the Cleveland Indians, at least they're saying, hey,
let's figure out a new name, so let's give ourselves a little bit of a window here. Let's get to the Cleveland Indians. So you said that they've been the Indians for 105 years, right?
105 years.
Which is extraordinary. But you know what? I looked this up. This franchise has had about a dozen names. They were the Bluebirds, the Broncos, the Napoleons, the Rustlers, the Spiders. Eventually, they became the Indians. You know why? Because of a player named Louis Sakalexis, who was a Native American who played in Cleveland in 1897 to 1899. So, like, you know, a long time ago. But they basically called the team the Indians because this guy played for a club called the Cleveland Spiders, and they decided that they wanted to, I guess they called the Spiders the Indians as like a, because he was on the team.
Right.
And so they said, like, well, we'll call the whole franchise the Indians. And so the name stuck. Anyway, my point is that the genesis of the term was an actual Native American, okay, who played in the league in 1897. And depending on how you look at this, because other people have different theories, he may have been the first Native American to ever play in the MLB. Okay. Right. So now we're jettisoning him from this.
But wouldn't it be awesome to actually honor his tribe?
The Sakalexis?
Of what he actually was?
Yeah, I don't know what his tribe was.
Right?
That'd be cool.
Like, imagine if he was Asian American. What would be the name there? They will come up with him from that time?
He was from the Penobscot tribe. Penobscot, which I never heard of. He was a Penobscot. Doesn't really roll off the tongue. It does not. I think the branding is not going to work on
that.
That's
probably why they went with that one.
But they
would have gone with Redskin, but it was already being used.
But my point is, and again, I don't know anything about Native Americans, so I decided to do a little bit of digging, and I went to the National Museum of the American Indian in the Smithsonian Institute. And specifically, there is a literal, like, giant display that says, what is the correct terminology? American Indian, Indian, Native American, or Native? The answer is, from the National Museum of the American Indian at the Smithsonian Institute, it says, all of these terms are acceptable. The consensus, however, is that whenever possible, to your point, Jesus, Native people prefer to be called by their specific tribal name.
Sure.
In the U.S., Native American has been widely used but is falling out of favor with some groups, and the terms American Indian or Indigenous American are preferred by many Native people. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm thinking to myself, here's a baseball team that was named after an actual Native American, or in this case, according to the Smithsonian, an American Indian, because that's the preference that they have, and we're getting rid of, who's getting rid of this term? How many Native Americans are responsible in this getting rid of this term, do you think?
Yeah, I have no idea.
I bet you it's zero. I bet you it's zero Native Americans are responsible.
I don't agree with that. Okay. I think that's, yeah.
Sounds awesome. I'm going to research this.
Sounds awesome. You should.
I'm going to research this. And I'm going to, anyway, it doesn't, my point is it's cringe for me, okay? Right. For a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that it seems that the Native American community prefers the term American Indian or Indian, and we're getting rid of that, and we're losing another opportunity to do honor to these people. Now, again, I agree with you on the whatever you mentioned his name was, the mascot.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah,
great. Yeah. I agree with you.
Chief Wahoo.
Chief Wahoo.
Love the name. Wahoo.
Speedy Gonzalez.
Oh, yeah.
So I agree with you on that.
Any sports team right now that think about Speedy Gonzalez being the mascot, don't.
Just stop in your tracks.
Stop.
But again, I think they've gone too far with the Indians. I think you could have done a rebrand. You could have found a new mascot. You could have done whatever. But there's nothing wrong with the term Indian. And I feel that now you're making it a dirty word.
Okay. Look, this is the case where I definitely would love to get some additional perspective of someone of people that are Native American, because I know for a number of these teams there have been quite a bit of protests over years. Now, maybe all of it was all centered around the mascot, because that was very, very controversial. But this is not a new thing. There's been a call to change the name, the mascot, etc. for a while. To your point, has, you know, the opinion about what terminology is changed over years, and maybe now it's actually more acceptable. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It still feels like part of a progression that probably should have happened a while ago.
Okay, so I'm a cringe on that. You're a courage, it sounds like. So we're going to end at a third, 0.33. Is that our average today?
I thought I said cringe just because it took them so long. But I mean, I agree with what they're doing. It just,
you think it's courageous or changing the name.
Yeah.
They're getting rid of Indians. I definitely think it's a cringe. Okay, yeah. So then we, whatever. You know, look, we some weeks we go up, some weeks we go down. This week we went down.
We're like the Gallup poll.
That's it. Apparently. Any words of wisdom, Jesus?
No words of wisdom.
You're completely unwise today.
Unwise, yes.
I think for me, the only thing that I go back to is spaces and places to have discussion with people that you don't necessarily agree with are at a premium. And I think that the data in our first study showed that. And I think that into 2021, God willing, we're moving into a moment where we can have more of those kinds of conversations.
You know what's interesting is the thing that my only point of wisdom, because I was having a conversation earlier today with one of our advisors for, you know, one of the ventures that we're launching. And we talked about this, that I think I really am hopeful that December 14th is a point of inflection for our trajectory as a country for a number of reasons. One is, and we actually talked about it both today already. One is the Electoral College officially saying that, you know, President-elect Biden has been elect, you know, is now the president-elect. And number two is the first vaccines were given out today. And look, we've had a rough year. I mean, there's no way to kind of go about it. There's so much uncertainty across a number of different things. And I'm hopeful that with today, we hopefully are starting to move in a path in a new direction. Still plenty of risks, still plenty of issues, reasons why we may disagree and not being in the same place. But I'm hopeful that people use it as an opportunity to literally turn the page and start fresh. So I'm maybe a little bit overly optimistic, but when those two things kind of were, I was reflecting on that earlier today, on those two things happening, all happening in the same day. And I am hopeful that we are at that inflection point where you see a clear change in direction of where we've been to where we're going, and I hope we all take advantage of it.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I'll remind everybody to check out Sofesa.org, the sponsor of this episode, SOFESA.org. Help a kid celebrate Christmas this year. And, you know, keep your thoughts and feedback coming in. We've gotten some good feedback on the show lately from some folks. And, you know, definitely reach out to us. You can reach us at blackbrown.us and let us know how you think we're doing. Always a privilege and a pleasure to be with you today. And we look forward to seeing you again on our next episode of TDR. If you enjoyed this episode of the Diversity Remix, please remember, first of all, to subscribe and help us to spread the word. Tell your friends, family, coworkers, and give us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your listening fix. And lastly, please remember to stop by blackbrown.us, the creator of this podcast, and take a look at our work and our approach at the intersection of diversity and business. The Diversity Remix is produced by Leo Gomez, with production services by Jose Manuel Durquidi and Luis Diego Carranza and our friends at Juan Diego Network. The Diversity Remix is a production of Black Brown.